Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Todd Cast. The end of the first 6 months of the year, not just the holiday week, getting ready for Independence Day. Washington, though, is emptying out ahead of the 4th of July weekend. The Senate is in recess, House leaving town for 2 weeks on Thursday afternoon. But before they go, congressional Democrats will vote to create a select committee on January 6th. Still on the table, how will Washington move forward on infrastructure? The focus on Democratic infighting over the deal obscures another question. Will any House Republicans vote for the Senate's bipartisan deal? Meanwhile, in the New York Democratic mayoral primary, the complicated ranked choice voting counting process hit a gigantic stumbling block when the Board of Elections announced a quote-unquote discrepancy in the count. Basically, the board included test ballots in their count, throwing the quality of the tally into question. Geez, is this a good time, if you're a Board of Elections in any city in America, a good time to have a bad day? So joining me today, Tara Palmieri, she's co-author of Political Playbook, and Benji Sarlin, he's our policy editor in the NBC News Political Unit. Tara and Benji, hello, hello.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Chuck.
Happy end of the first 6 months, which I kind of want to like do a step back at the end, but I want to dive into this New York City debacle here a minute. And you know, it wasn't my planned lead today, Tara. I take it wasn't your planned lead either with Playbook.
No, it wasn't. I mean, this is a huge flaw in the system and really a killer for the ranked choice voting movement. I don't see how they can survive after this. And it really was a political movement around the country. You saw it in San Francisco, even in the UK. And but the whole world is watching the New York City mayor race. It's basically the same as, you know, it might be one of the most influential positions in the country besides, you know, governor of California and obviously president of the United States. And to see it be thrown into chaos like this is just not great for ranked choice voting, which everybody in the city was already grumbling about already because no one really quite understood. And by everyone in the city, I mean, you know, political operatives in New York City, they just really didn't know how to play it. You saw towards the end, Andrew Yang and Catherine Garcia sort of teaming up, but not truly endorsing each other, which is sort of a tactic in ranked choice voting to, you know, support the to support an opponent as the second choice. And it just, I think this whole debacle is terrible for ranked choice voting, but also it brings us back to this, to what we've been dealing with for the past 6 months and longer since the election in, you know, since the presidential election, is this sort of distrust in electoral systems. And we now have Democratic leaders like Eric Adams saying, you know, can we trust the results? And it sounds a lot like someone that we've been hearing from a lot, former President Trump. Yeah. And it's just, I don't know, it's not great for democracy either.
No, it feels like a big blow. You know, Benji, we were talking about this a lot yesterday in one of our planning meetings. And so I know you have a lot of thoughts on this, but my God, it feels like the biggest mistake that was made here was we needed to figure out how to release all of the ballot results, first, second, third, fourth, and fifth for everything out there, for every voting group, in order to create the ability essentially for the public to double check the Board of Elections. I mean, what already felt opaque and a black box just got darker and another lock got put on it.
Yeah. And as people have been pointing out, this probably has less to do with the specifics of ranked choice voting itself, which has already worked in other places, than New York's Board of Elections, which has just famously been a bit of a disaster zone. And one of the aspects of this new focus on voting rights and ways to make voting more convenient and fair is that blue states like New York that get less attention in presidential years because they're the outcomes never in question are getting put more in the spotlight, right, for their own practices. Because in New York, historically, it's been much harder to vote than in some of these swing states like Georgia.
I would argue it's probably for per capita one of the worst voting systems in the country.
Yeah, and you're starting to see some changes in terms of making it more convenient to vote, but there's also been this separate issue of administration. I mean, when I started out as a reporter, I was in the local New York City politics beat. And Mayor Bloomberg was one of his absolute biggest villains that he just loved to criticize at every turn, was the local board of elections, because even then it was being constantly accused of being packed with kind of machine politics cronies to run things who were just not competent. And you would end up with all these kinds of embarrassments. And it's been this complete kind of failure to fix the system, even though they've known they have these problems the entire time. So I think it is unfortunate that, you know, ranked choice voting, whether you agree or disagree with it, is kind of being sucked into it. But at the very least, it shines the biggest spotlight yet on the fact New York City has these serious problems with how it conducts elections.
Well, and the thing is, look, we're Terry, you brought up the larger fallout, right? The guy who's trying to destroy our democracy one silly audit and press release at a time suddenly gets a talking point from his old hometown, and he'll do his best to conflate it.
And from the Democratic Party.
Right. But let's talk about, like, what's needed immediately to try to stem this disaster. It's like, you know, what's the tourniquet for the Board of Elections now?
I think it takes about a week to update the votes, right? Isn't that what happened? So we saw an initial tally right after the vote last week, and then we saw another tally this week. And I think that they need to act quickly, and we shouldn't have to be waiting weeks for results. Like, this needs to be dealt with immediately. And I think the longer that there are questions about the results, the less confidence that there is going to be in the New York City Electoral Board. And it's just a matter of getting ahead of it and not waiting on it. I didn't really quite understand why it was going to take a week to fully tally up all of these votes, especially since it is a computer system, right? Why did it take a full week to give us a first initial voting record and then a follow-up a week later? I think they need to address this right now.
You know, it's interesting, Ben. I'm pretty neutral on ranked choice voting. I hate runoffs. And you know, because of how disenfranchising it is. So if you believe you need a runoff and you want a majority, I get the appeal of ranked choice. It feels like the real issue here is we need to learn how to deliver ranked choice results in real time better and clearer. And look, let's set aside the New York City Board of Elections. That is a problem. They can't handle normal elections. We're asking them to do something else. But let's assume we can put competent people there. How we're releasing the results is still problematic right now, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not like this is an unfixable problem necessarily, depending on how you set the rules, depending on how you assign resources. You know, it's even aside from ranked choice voting, you know, New York was notoriously slow at counting votes even before this. And again, it was often in races that didn't matter, but you saw, especially with some of the close house races.
Oh my God.
Just after 2020, they were taking forever.
Yeah, we were waiting for absentee ballots for about a month in Jamal Bowman's race, right? Against
Exactly. And it's become a running joke, you know, among, for example, you know, back in your native Florida, you know, after they had an electoral debacle in 2000, they've become very efficient at, you know, figuring out a system that can very quickly count up who won. And I noticed there was, you know, some bragging going on from Republicans and Democrats in Florida over the last, you know, year or so, every time New York is slow counting their ballots or has some snafu like that, saying, hey, we, you know, you should become like Florida. So it's not like there aren't ways to speed things up with a different system, with some tweaks, with some changes to administration. But yeah, the longer you take, the more room there is also for conspiracy theories and doubt to creep in.
Yeah, that's big. Look, Kentucky, Virginia, and Florida, I feel like are the when I think about election results that I follow, that I care about, when they're close elections, those three states count fast, Tara. They count accurately. Right. As Benji pointed out here, Florida had the debacle of a lifetime. And, you know, they radically changed their systems. And now the most reliable place to get data is from the Secretary of State's site. Ditto in the state of Virginia, ditto in the state of Kentucky. Why is this not replicatable? And these are three distinct states. They're not really alike in any way culturally.
And why not in New York City, which has a huge budget, has the political will to handle something like this, and the Capitol? I don't understand why we're waiting for weeks every time there's an election. Also, 100,000 test votes. I'm not sure I understand this, but what are they even doing in the system?
Okay. So I will, let me give you, I'll do a, there is a need for test votes. Okay.
Okay.
And I'd say we do it at NBC during every election. And boy, do we have like, we have all these, you know, safeguards. We put like a watermark on the graphic that say test votes and all this stuff so that if it accidentally leaks out. But one of the things we want to test is we want to test to see if we're getting our data stream from our partnership at Edison, you know, the folks at Edison who we all contract with, or at least the major networks or what's left of us contract with. So I understand overall, you do need to test your system. So it's a good practice, but how the hell are you? It would be like trust me, if somebody at NBC put up the wrong data set on an election result, somebody would be fired.
It would be chaos.
Right. It would be right. I mean, imagine the dunking on us. Forget the dunking on it. It would be a crisis. It would create a crisis in our credibility as a journalistic organization. Right. So look, I mean, the good news is, yes, you do need to test these systems. You do need quote unquote test votes to make sure you've figured out how, if you've tried to automate some thing, you know, for us, it's a graphic issue that we're testing and things like that. So I'm not going to sit here and dunk on them for doing a test vote.
Right.
But how the hell do you mix the data?
Like, well, the problem.
Yeah.
So, that's sorry, the part I didn't say that. Figure
out. No, it's all right. I was just at least like, I don't, there is a reason to do it, but don't be so incompetent to mix your data.
Well, it's also that they were so incompetent to begin with. And then to throw in a whole new way of voting into the mix, this was just inevitable. I think there was going to be disaster.
Yeah, I think sadly we saw it. All right, let me switch gears to what both of you are very acutely, uniquely qualified to talk about, and that is the summer of infrastructure. We've gotten rid of Infrastructure Week, and we now have the season of infrastructure, I guess. So we're going to spend our summer on these infrastructure deals. Our little
make it stop.
I do want to get at something.
I'm in my element. I love it.
Infrastructure, I know you do, Benji. Trust me. And I want to get at something. And Benji and Tara, you guys were having. I came in as we were doing our pregame here, and I interrupted a conversation you were having. So Benji, some of Tara's reporting seemed to start a little dust fire on the latest of how big is the infrastructure bill going to be. What's final? What's not? I assume this has to do with the idea of, is the physical infrastructure number set, period? Don't put any more in reconciliation. Is that the debate?
Yeah. Tara and I are going to try to walk through this, I think. Let's see if we can get through this reporting here. So if you've been following the infrastructure deal, you know that there is a lot of argument over the process and the order of which thing goes into which bill and how much. So what's going on here is that there's a bipartisan deal on what's called, you know, let's call it traditional infrastructure, you know, roads, bridges. You could throw things like broadband in there. There is some money for things like electric vehicle charging stations. But there isn't this whole separate, you know, list of items that Biden wants to pass from his jobs and families plan, which is everything from hundreds of billions of dollars for elder care or right. to subsidize affordable housing or for various climate initiatives or healthcare, and none of his tax increases. So there's this, you know, trillions of dollars that is just not being discussed at all in this bipartisan deal. And right now, the big issue is that Democrats are nervous about this bipartisan deal, not because of much of the detail of, you know, the substance of what's in it, because they're worried that they won't get all that other spending, that they won't be able to go to a reconciliation bill, which only requires Democrats, and that they won't be able to get agreement to get that other spending. They're afraid that once the moderates, like, say, Joe Manchin, get what they want in infrastructure, maybe they won't be as keen on passing the rest of Biden's agenda because they feel like they have something and they don't want to touch some of the more divisive topics. Now, Tara had some very interesting reporting today in Playbook, which was that the White House, as part of its deal with Republicans on just infrastructure, just as bipartisan deal, said, look, when we agree to a top line number on something we discussed, we're not going to go back and add money to it in reconciliation later. So, for example, if they reached a deal that you're going to spend this much money on Amtrak, Democrats are not going to go back in a bill later and say, well, we're going to double it. You know, that issue is considered settled. But what that still means is that the White House, any issue that they did not discuss in their talks with Republicans, they can still try to get into a reconciliation bill. So they didn't talk about, affordable housing with Republicans in a bipartisan deal. Still can spend whatever you want on that, whatever Joe Manchin and Bernie Sanders will agree to, you know, along with the House. They didn't talk about a lot of climate initiatives. Still can put that in a bill. There was some confusion, though, because some people seem to interpret this as, oh, man, Biden's selling out the left. He's saying that, you know, everything from his jobs plan is no longer on the table. And, you know, now they won't be negotiating over any of it. That's not what happened. But it is, as you can tell just from my description, incredibly confusing, even just laying out the process here and what's at stake.
All right, Tara, did Benji do you justice here in this reporting? And are you surprised at how people are taking your reporting and misinterpreting it, perhaps purposely?
Well, we were actually just checking in on what the president said himself. I mean, he was the one who said at the press conference to celebrate the deal that they wouldn't be double dipping. They wouldn't be, you know, doubling the amount of money spent for roads, bridges, public transportation, and that there would be no parallel use of this Democrats only reconciliation package. So we wanted to make sure the same, because we figured this would infuriate a lot of progressives and Democrats that want more spending. But, you know, in some ways, it helps sell the package to Republicans, right? Because it makes them feel like they're winning in some way. You know, if they put a cap on how much they're going to spend on electric vehicles in this bill, it makes Republicans, they can go home and say, well, you know, we got that infrastructure bill down by whatever, $400 billion from what it was originally going to be. You know, otherwise, really, what's the point in doing a bipartisan bill if you could just do one bill through reconciliation and it would just be exactly what they want? I mean, that's pretty much, there really is no compromise if you're just going to do everything you didn't get in another bill.
I am surprised that some, look, I get that some people want to hear what they want to hear. And I think that's the biggest problem we have this week is people are choosing to hear what they want to hear. And maybe that'll be good news for Biden. If he can sort of keep people thinking, hey, just hear what you want to hear in a good way, and let's see how far we take this. But look,
there's so many items in it. It's just going to flood the zone. I know. Do you think in the end that people are going to nitpick every item in these packages, or is it just going to be passes and we move on, and some people campaign on it and some don't, and some people campaign on it who didn't vote for it?
Right. Benji,
go ahead.
To your point there, that's one of the reasons the politics of this are a little confusing too, right? Because there's been, you know, a lot of progressives very agitated over the process around this bipartisan deal. What you've seen is very little substantive criticism of the actual stuff they negotiated. It's most like if Biden's not able to add more spending to some of these items in the bipartisan deal, that doesn't really affect progressives too much. They're mostly just worried they won't get to spending money on the things they do care about, which is why it's so important to them. There's a second.
All right. I want to give you an out question. What's the chances this reconciliation bill is successful and the number is north of $3 trillion, Benji?
The reconciliation bill with the number north of $3 trillion? 0% chance.
Yeah.
So my guess, the main obstacle here is the pay fors. Joe Manchin has been a little confusing at times, you know, as of some of the other moderates in what they're actually asking for substantively and what their red lines are on. But the main takeaway from what people like Manchin have been saying is you can spend up to $4 trillion is the number he's used in the past, but you're going to have to pay for it all. And they used kind of, I don't know, like wishy-washy, not very real, you know, pay-fors with this bipartisan deal. But that's unlikely to be the case with this reconciliation one. They're going to have actual, you know, tax increases. And it's very hard to raise that much money without losing some of the moderates.
So what do you think the max number of, I mean, so let's get to the brass tacks. So you think the pay-fors, if they can get whatever they get to, $2 trillion, $2.2, $2.3, and I guess most of it's got to come from the increase in the corporate tax rate, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the $2 trillion might be a decent number just because it's sort of a mirror image of the Trump tax cuts. Right. If you wanted to find that money, it certainly seems possible. You'll see how much moderates object or not. But you can do things like raise the corporate tax rate, maybe not to the level that Biden asked for, but something. You can raise capital gains, maybe not to the level Biden asked for, but to something. There are menu items that you could add onto there that Biden did not ask for. For example, one idea that's been thrown out to fund Democratic ideas in the past, you could do, for example, a financial transaction tax, maybe do a very small number on a, you know, on a stock trades by big institutional traders, say. That could get you some money. There are ways to try to find pay-fors beyond what they've named too. But once you get beyond a couple of trillion dollars, it gets harder and harder, especially because some of the moderates are going to be demanding tax cuts.
Once you get beyond a couple of trillion dollars, this is why.
Isn't it amazing? Remember during the stimulus, the Obama stimulus, $800 billion was considered outrageous. And now we're like, trillion, $2 trillion, whatever.
Kara, I know you're on a, we're all on some tight deadlines here. So I want to give you this out question slightly different that takes us to January 6th commission. Here we are almost 6 months removed from January 6th. And it feels like the House Republicans have gotten somehow more radicalized about January 6th in ways that I don't think any of us thought was possible. Is that fair?
I think you're right. I think they really have just sort of dug their heels in on this, and they are not willing to accept that there was an actual insurrection, a revolt against our democracy on the steps of the Capitol, and they don't want to acknowledge it. I mean, this was a homegrown terrorist attack, and we're just going to act like it never happened. And it's just kind of a surreal experience to cover, you know, the Hill, to cover Washington, and know that this is all going on in the background. It's hard to take them seriously on things like the infrastructure bill when you know that they won't even accept the reality. The fact that we're only getting a select committee, that was supposed to be a sideshow to the commission. And that's all we're getting now is a select committee.
Let me ask you this, though. Is Liz Cheney one of Pelosi's picks? Does that really, in your mind, help legitimize the select committee? Look, I do think people forget how, no matter what anybody thought of Benghazi, and it was negatively viewed, it had a huge impact. And it had power.
No, you're right.
And they had, and they, you know, the Hillary Clinton emails are why, you know, came from the Benghazi committee.
They tanked her campaign. I mean,
yeah, there will be real substance that will stick to some of these folks for a long time. But the question is public credibility. How important is Liz Cheney being a part of this hearing on the D side to giving this public credibility?
I think they need a Republican. Does it have to be Liz Cheney? I'm not sure. Maybe a Kinzinger might be a more low-key choice. You know, just having Cheney there, she might end up just stealing the show, and you might forget who is actually running the select committee. You know, so it doesn't have to be Liz Cheney. I mean, that would be a bold choice. It would certainly attract a lot of press. This would become the main, you know, the main item in Washington right now. But at the end of the day, is that what Pelosi wants? Does she want to hand over her select committee to a Cheney? I don't know. We'll see what
Benji,
happens.
Well, how important do you think Liz Cheney is to this process for the public credibility?
I think I agree with Tara that the importance of a Republican is very important. Liz Cheney may or may not be the boost you need. One thing to remember is that there's only so much credibility you actually get from adding a Republican like Liz Cheney, because remember, Liz Cheney just got purged from the party. You know, this is the issue that is getting people purged from the party. You are almost by nature seen as, how would you call it? Like, you know, irredeemably never Trump and thus can't be trusted. There's no one who's going to have, you know, truck with that side by appointing them. But I think the really important thing here, regardless of who they appoint, is just whether you produce new facts. I mean, one of the things hanging over the impeachment is we still didn't know so much about the basic timeline of what happened, of what the president was doing all day and who he was speaking to and which orders he was considering or turning down. And when you have subpoena power, maybe you can start really figuring that out. And if there's substance there, I mean, that's something that keeps the story going that could affect how we view what happened that day, you know, going forward in the future. I think that's really what's going to determine how this panel matters.
Now, I think it turns into an interesting drip-drip, which is why Kevin McCarthy knows all too well how effective a select committee can be. All right, Tara, Benji, I said I'd get you out of here. I'm 3 minutes late. My apologies. but happy 6 months. And the first 6 months of 2021 are gone. They're at least better than the first 6 months of 2020. That's about all we can say.
You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Green and Matt Rivera. John Reese is our executive producer, and our theme music composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1. Meet the Press Reports is on demand on Peacock. The Big Show is every Sunday morning. So thanks for listening until we upload again.